Good afternoon, and welcome to the Best of NERA 2010, broadcast by the SEC Historical Society on www.sechistorical.org. My name is Lisa Fairfax, and I am the Leroy Soros and Merrifield Research Professor of Law at the George Washington University School of Law, and I am moderator of today's program. The SEC Historical Society shares, preserves, and advances knowledge of the history of financial regulation through its virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org. The museum is the authoritative online source on the history of financial regulation from the 20th century to the present. It is free and accessible worldwide at all times. The virtual museum and archive, as well as the society, is a separate and independent body from the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission and receives no government funding. We therefore thank the gifts and grants from many institutions and individuals who make possible the growth and outreach of the museum to over 15,000 visitors each month. Since 2004, in partnership with NERA Economic Consulting, the Virtual Museum and Archive has annually broadcast the Best of NERA, highlighting top presentations from NERA Economic Consulting's recent Finance, Law, and Securities Litigation Seminar. The Society is grateful for the continuing generous sponsorship of NERA Economic Consulting for this series. Past broadcasts from the series can be accessed at any time in both audio, MP3, and edited transcript formats in the Best of NERA section of programs at www.sechistorical.org. I am especially delighted to welcome you to today's program. First, let me introduce to you our speakers for today. Christopher Larson, Senior Consultant, who will be discussing structured finance issues. We welcome Chris to the program. Dr. Chiduzi Okongwu, Senior Vice President, with his insights on disclosure in regards to the sale of structured products. Chu also presented in the 2008 program. And then finally, Dr. Elaine Buckbird, Senior Vice President, who will be looking at quantifying SEC settlement since the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. This is Elaine's fourth appearance in the series. She was also part of the 2004, 2006, and 2008 broadcasts. So now we're going to start our program, and we're going to first hear from Chris. So Chris, welcome to the program, and please tell us about structured products.
Thanks, Lisa. So my talk today is going to be on structured finance, and what I want to do is lay some groundwork in the area. I think there's been a lot of soundbite-based characterizations of structured finance, which as a broad class can mischaracterize some of the realities. And so what I want to do is talk about some misconceptions and try to provide some background that hopefully provide a trail to some more objective truth. First, I'm going to do that by way of some factual items, and then I'm also going to compare structured finance to corporate issuances. So first of all, I think it's important to know, what is structured finance? What are we talking about today? There's various types of structured finance. Structured finance might be a bank deposit whose return is linked to the S&P 500 or some other index. It might be a subordinated corporate bond that has a payment in kind provision, or it could be an asset-backed security that's has underlyings of aircraft leases or some other asset class. The structured finance I'm going to talk about today is essentially the asset-backed security brand. So what do we mean when we say asset-backed security? Well, asset-backed securities, you typically have groups of financial assets, often that are relatively small denomination or less liquid, that are pooled together. And they're pooled typically by a trust or other special purpose corporation, which issues various securities to fund that pool. The interest in principle of the structured finance securities comes from the interest in principle and sometimes the collateral liquidation of the underlying loans, leases, or other financial assets. So asset-backed security can be used as a very broad term. You could have auto loans underlying or credit cards, but there's many other subtypes depending on the financial assets that's in the pool. Clearly, a mortgage-backed security is going to have underlying mortgages, and a CDO is actually just an asset-backed security with a single or a mixed type of collateral pool underlying it. So I think getting at the first misconception that's out there in the press generally might be that, is structured finance or asset-backed securities, does it really make sense? Or was it just for the big financial institutions? Was it just the ploy all along? And so the background of that is pretty simple. When you pool different types of assets and divide them up into different classes of securities, you end up with securities that have different risk and return characteristics. So what that does is it creates different diversification opportunities for someone that has a desired risk tolerance. So say you're an investor with a very low risk tolerance. You want high credit quality, AAA type of credit quality, but not U.S. government debt. If you don't have structured finance, there's only 5 or 6 traditional corporations in the U.S. whose debt's rated AAA. So you're very limited into types of positions that you can purchase. Structured finance broadens that. So you can buy high-quality credit in mortgages, autos, ship leases, another type of asset class. And that diversification that, as an investor, you can obtain allows you to reduce your risk. So there is a investor-driven purpose for these types of positions. But even more broadly, the supply of credit to these underlying asset classes reduces the cost to the ultimate borrower. So whether you're a consumer or a business, now there's many, many more classes of investors who are investing in your underlying class. That reduces the borrowing costs, which is also good broadly. So there's a real rationale and positive economic impact for asset-backed securities to exist. So that's sort of the general background and what I wanted to start off with. But in terms of some other labeling and misconceptions, I thought it would be interesting to talk about the idea that structured finance is toxic. So no matter what underlying asset class or what level in the capital structure or tranche you might have owned, you can find some place that's labeled these securities as toxic. And it's no secret that the performance on many asset-backed securities issuances has been much worse than initially expected by many investors or analysts. But that's not really at issue here. I think the question I have is, why aren't U.S. corporate debt issuances labeled toxic? And so the background that I want to talk about a little bit is just, were the U.S. corporate issuances such better performing issues versus asset-backed securities? So let's think about this in terms of the credit crisis. In 2007, about 25% of the Lehman High Yield Corporate Bond Index was comprised of financial company issues. And as we all know, most of the large financial corporations, and by extension, the securities they issued, were supported by the U.S. government. Beyond the financial institutions, though, we know the Federal Reserve, the Treasury, and other government entities instituted numerous unprecedented programs to support corporate America. So you can think about the target Fed funds rate going down to zero, which reduces floating rate borrowing costs. But then there's specific programs like the commercial paper backstop, which allowed corporations to sell their commercial paper directly to the Federal Reserve to allow them to roll that paper, whereas otherwise they might have a problem with their liquidity. The same issue with money market bailouts. Money market funds were effectively guaranteed. That allowed the money markets to roll the short-term debt that they were purchasing from the corporates in the U.S. Without those types of programs, a lot of corporate America could have become illiquid quite quickly and led to many more defaults or poor performance on those issuances. And of course, we know about the massive infusions into the government-sponsored entities Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and those, of course, had issued many, many bonds and as well. So I think the point of the matter is that if we start labeling one class toxic, I think we need to think broadly and understand the weaknesses throughout the economy that were prevalent back prior to the credit crisis and what actually happened. So a few other misconceptions that I've heard out there in the press and in general. One is structured finance was new, untested, and designed to fail. So the facts are asset-backed securities have been around for a long time. CDOs were created around the same time that high-yield corporate debt issuances began starting to be issued in the U.S. in the 1980s. And CMO tranches have been a prevalent part of community bank investment portfolios since the early 1990s, if not before. So that's the idea that these products are new, that these structures are new, simply isn't founded. Were they untested? Well, if you go back to the 1980s, clearly through that time until now, we've gone through recessions. We've gone through significant regional real estate declines. The long-term capital management issues, the dot-com bubble, 9/11, Enron, and WorldCom. So it's not really fair to say that structured finance is untested. And was it designed to fail? Again, the decades of experience with this product, and even in late 2006, structured finance was essentially endorsed by U.S. interagency group of regulators from the SEC to the Fed to the OCC that stated that structured finance had a well-established track record and it was essential an essential part of U.S. and international capital markets. So I think those facts speak for themselves with respect to whether structured finance, meaning asset-backed securities, if they were new, untested, and designed to fail. I think the final thing I want to talk about is this complexity issue with structured finance. Are the structured finance issue is really uniquely complex and difficult to analyze? And we can think about three terms that are applied a lot of times to structured finance, and that's tranches, implicit leverage, and correlation. I just want to explain these concepts and compare them a little bit to the corporate issuances. First of all, tranches. All the tranches are securities within a capital structure. Each tranche is a separate security. Debt and equity within a corporate capital structure is also tranched, if you will. There's pieces that are at the top of the capital structure, and the equity, being the residual, is at the bottom of the capital structure. So this idea of tranching, it's a 50-cent word, but really it's been in existence within corporate finance for a long time. Implicit leverage, that just reflects this level in the capital structure or the subordination. So a piece of a security that's issued and is senior to another security, that creates implicit leverage. Within the lower class security, there's implicit leverage. At least that's what the term that's been used in Wall Street. But this isn't different within structured finance or corporate. A subordinated piece of debt issued by traditional corporation like Ford or Best Buy, those also would have implicit leverage under that concept. Finally, correlation. So this is just the idea that the underlying assets or activities within a pool of assets or within a business, it matters with respect to the cash flows. With the underlying assets in asset-backed security, you've got mortgages or you've got auto loans. If all of those tend not to pay at the same time, then the performance on the various securities or tranches will not do so well. But the same is true with businesses within a corporation or legal entities under a holding company. It's important how all those activities perform in relation to one another and the timing. So the concept is pretty simple. As long as Ford sells enough cars or GM sells enough cars, all the capital structure components, all the liabilities and debt and equity are going to get paid. And if you don't sell enough cars, they won't all get paid. The same is true in asset-backed securities. If people pay their mortgages as expected, everyone gets paid. If not, you're going to have a different result. And so whether you're talking about General Motors or certain asset-backed securities, at the end of the day, not enough people paid their mortgages or purchased enough cars. So I think I'll stop there as a sort of introduction, and we can ask questions or move on.
Absolutely. Thank you. We're going to do a Q&A after we hear from all of the speakers, but I would like to thank you. I think you're exactly right. There's a lot of, I think, negative press about structured finance in general and asset-backed securities in particular. So I thank you for that discussion and also the discussion of some of the key misconceptions around those issues. Now we're going to turn it over to Chu, who's going to talk to us about structured products.
Thank you. I'm going to be speaking about CDOs and structured finance securities and some of the issues that have arisen with them as a result of the credit crisis. Now, such securities played a pivotal role in the credit crisis, and this has resulted in a plethora of litigation concerning them. At issue is often the question of whether the problems that such securities have had were due to exogenous factors or the result of the fact that certain entities did not adequately perform the roles expected of them, or even in some cases, acted in a manner that was counter to the way in which they should have acted. I'll discuss some such cases and the role that economic analyses can play in the absence of factual evidence such as emails, meeting minutes, and the like. In many cases, economic analysis of the data can help identify and quantify patterns that can answer key questions about the roles played by certain entities in specific transactions. In many of the structured finance transactions that are now in dispute, a key issue is that of alleged conflicts of interest among various agents involved in the deals. However, such conflicts are part of many economic transactions, and agents are typically aware of them and make decisions accordingly. Unanticipated losses due to such conflicts should only result in cases where there's asymmetrical information and the ability to control the performance of some aspect of the deals. Now, in your typical CDO transaction, for example, there are many parties that play various roles. For example, you have originators, servicers, underwriters, collateral managers, rating agencies, and many others. And certain parties can play multiple roles. An economist would think about some of these entities as principals and others as agents. For example, you might think about a servicer as an agent of the investors in the deal. The fact that certain entities play multiple roles in CDO transactions is alleged to have led to instances in which asymmetrical information was able to be used to these parties' advantage. Key questions in such cases are, what could they know? When could they know it? And what could they have done about it? An economist approaches such a problem by gathering data and subjecting it to thorough analysis. One could do this by comparing the performance of similar functions in dissimilar structures. Academics have actually done this, and have obtained some interesting and suggestive results. For example, one academic study found that mortgages in asset-backed securities have a 50% higher delinquency rate if the originators and the underwriters are different. Another story examines servicers. Now, servicing can either be performed by affiliates of the underwriter or by others. The study found that asset-backed securities issued by underwriters with a servicer under the same parent company retained their initial rating for 17% longer than asset-backed securities with third-party servicers. Now, these are interesting because they're suggestive both of asymmetrical information, the first case, and in the second case, the ability to control an outcome. Again, we see the key concepts here. Distinguishing instances where these, as opposed to exogenous factors, were the drivers of deal performance is often our task. Now, we can think of many other instances of asymmetrical information and the ability to control outcome. So under asymmetrical information, we know, for example, studies have found that low-quality borrowers disproportionately choose not to provide documentation of income and assets. We know that there have been some instances in which collateral characteristics have been knowingly misreported. It's alleged that in some instances, the level of detail available to certain investors was different than that available to other investors. And it's alleged that in some deals, collateral has been overvalued. All these instances of asymmetrical information can result in bad outcomes. When one thinks about control, one could think about instances in which it's alleged that loans were not modified as could reasonably be expected, or were not foreclosed promptly, or were improperly substituted into deals. Now, our task is to figure out when such instances occur versus when collateral performs badly merely due to macroeconomic factors. Such issues are at the heart of the recently settled SEC case against Goldman Sachs. You may recall that the SEC sued Goldman Sachs for failing to disclose to investors that securities underlying a synthetic CDO transaction were selected with the assistance of a party shorting the deal. In the transaction, Paulson & Company, a major hedge fund, paid Goldman Sachs $15 million to structure and market a CDO secured by mortgage collateral. A third-party firm, ACA, agreed to become the portfolio selection agent and ultimately approved the selection of 55 of 123 mortgage-backed securities picked by Paulson. Paulson then shorted the CDO by entering into a credit default swap with Goldman Sachs. Within 9 months after the deal closed, 99% of the CDO had been downgraded. Investors lost a little over $1 billion. The biggest loser was ABN AMRO. It lost $841 million. And the bank IKB lost $150 million. Most of that money went to Paulson to settle the credit default swap transaction. Goldman Sachs and Paulson initially contended that the nature of the deal and the sophistication of the investors rendered the disclosure of Paulson's role in selecting the portfolio, as well as his short position, unnecessary. However, on July 15th, Goldman Sachs and the SEC agreed to a $550 million settlement. Goldman Sachs acknowledged that its marketing materials for the transaction were incomplete and that it was a mistake to state that the portfolio was selected by ACA without disclosing Paulson's role in the selection process and that Paulson's economic interests were adverse to those of the CDO investors. In other words, it acknowledged that the asymmetrical information was a problem. Now, the CDO portfolio contained 90 securities rated BAA by Moody's. It's interesting, one thing that one can tease out of the data is that the SEC complaint stated that by October 24th, 2007, 83% of the securities in the portfolio had been downgraded. I'd note that by contrast, Moody's states that by October 22nd, 2007, 91% of all BAA-rated subprime mortgage securities have been downgraded. This suggests that at least in one dimension, the CDO collateral performed better than average. Another interesting case is the investigation of the hedge fund Magnetar Capital by the SEC. Magnetar invested in the equity tranche of CDOs. It also bought protection via CDS on the deals. These yielded large profits when the deals performed badly. Key issues being examined are Magnetar's role, if any, in the portfolio selection process. Magnetar told investors it did not control the selection process, but did communicate with banks and asset managers when the deals were being structured. Other issues being examined are how the assets in the CDOs were valued when the deal was structured, what triggers were put in place to determine how certain investors would incur losses, and at what point the firms involved in the deals decided to bet against the deals. Now, an interesting observation is that as Magnetar held both the equity tranche of the deal, and as well as CDS that were short the deals, it would have made money if the deal had done very well, in which case the equity investment would have paid off, or if the deals had done very badly, via the short CDS positions. Its position was really a bet on volatility, and to make large profits, Magnetar needed the portfolio to do really well or really badly. As such, it would be in its interest to select highly correlated assets. One way in which to examine its claim that it did not control the asset selection process in the CDOs in which it participated might be to analyze the correlation of the portfolio assets relative to the market. And this brings me back to where I started, because like the Goldman case, and by the way, the SEC is investigating a second deal by Goldman, where Goldman selected the assets for the deal and also bought credit protection on the deal. The key issues here in the Magnetar case concern asymmetrical information and control. In other words, what did they know, when did they know, and what could they do about it? Because often the answers to such questions are not directly observable, economic analysis can be a valuable tool because it can allow us to infer the answers to some of these, to the questions by looking at the data. That's the end of my talk.
Thank you very much. It's very intriguing conversation, particularly with respect to asymmetrical information. And we'll certainly get back to that that discussion in our Q&A. Next, we're going to have Elaine talk to us about settlements.
Thank you, Lisa. SEC settlements have been in renewed focus since the SEC first filed its complaint against Goldman. The press began to speculate about how large the settlement would be. Today, I'll discuss SEC settlements since Sarbanes-Oxley, focusing on settlements with companies, and then following on some of Chu's discussion of the Goldman case, we'll talk a little bit about the settlement. Sarbanes-Oxley was a major turning point in SEC settlements. Prior to Sarbanes-Oxley, the single largest SEC penalty against a public company was a $10 million settlement earlier in 2002. Since, the settlements have run in the hundreds of millions. Indeed, we had three settlements in excess of $100 million thus far this year. The Goldman Sachs settlement, of course, at $550 million, the State Street Bank and Trust settlement at $314 million, and the Bank of America Merrill settlement at $150 million. But prior to 1990, the SEC had authority to levy penalties only for insider trading. The Securities Enforcement Remedies Act of 1990 changed that, giving the SEC penalty authority for any securities law violation. However, penalties were deposited to the U.S. Treasury, so they became government revenue. Section 308 of Sarbanes-Oxley enabled the SEC to use penalties to create so-called fair funds, which can then be distributed to harmed investors. With the ability to use penalties to compensate investors rather than to add to government revenue, the SEC began to levy much larger penalties. Compared to that then record-setting $10 million Xerox settlement, the top 10 settlements now range from $800 million down to $250 million. All of these top 10 settlements are with public financial companies or their subsidiaries. That $550 million settlement with Goldman ranks third after an $800 million settlement with AIG and a $750 million settlement with WorldCom. On January 4th, 2006, the SEC issued guidance about how it thought about arriving at settlement amounts with public companies. The guidance came on a day when the SEC was announcing two settlements with public companies, a settlement with McAfee for $50 million and a settlement with Applix that carried no financial settlement aspects. The SEC stated, quote, "Our view of the appropriateness of a penalty on the corporation in a particular case turns principally on two considerations, the presence or absence of a direct benefit to the corporation as a result of the violation, and the degree to which the penalty will recompense or further harm the injured shareholders," end quote. The SEC also named a number of additional considerations, which I would summarize as the magnitude of the harm to investors, the need for deterrence, the egregiousness of the fraudulent activity, and the qualities of the corporation's cooperation with the SEC once the investigation began. Many settlements still have no financial component, like that Applix settlement. Of post-Sarbanes-Oxley settlements, 44% of company settlements involve no financial penalty, where here I'm speaking about private and public companies. If we look at a group of settlements that are all with public companies, so settlements with public companies involving misstatements, which would be the parallel to 10b-5 shareholder or securities class actions, fully 72% of these settlements since Sarbanes-Oxley involve no financial component. So those huge headline-making settlements are still a small proportion of the approximately 750 settlements that the SEC reaches every year on average. The number of settlements is up thus far this year, in fiscal year 2010, that is, but still below the post-Sarbanes-Oxley average of 750 approximately. And based on the settlements in the first 9 months of the fiscal year, this year is likely to yield 676 settlements, up from the post-Sarbanes-Oxley low of 616. in 2009. On average, about one quarter of the settlements are with companies. The remaining three quarters are with individuals. Now, the SEC brings cases and reaches settlements in both federal court and administrative proceedings, with about 54% in federal court. Whether the SEC will opt for an administrative proceeding versus a federal court action depends on the kind of case, the penalty sought, and tactical issues. An administrative proceeding is the only way the SEC can address the failure of an SEC-regulated entity to properly supervise its employees, for example. On the other hand, only in federal court can the SEC bring a case against entities or individuals it does not regulate. Also, another advantage of administrative proceedings is it gives the SEC nationwide subpoena power, as opposed to the 100-mile rule that applies in federal court. In terms of settlement size, the annual average company settlement, so the average for any given year, has ranged from $5 million to $25 million since Sarbanes-Oxley. For the fiscal year, from October 1, 2009 to mid-June, thus far this year, the average settlement was $11 million. But median company settlement, so your 50th percentile settlement, is typically much lower, so generally in about the $1 million range. With respect to settlements with public companies, we find that non-zero settlements are increasing in the company's market capitalization. That is, if we have a settlement that involves a financial amount, we find that there's a statistically significant positive relationship between the settlement size and the market capitalization of the company. We've got over 70% of settlements with public companies involving misstatements involve no financial penalty. Another 21% are still under $50 million. So only about 7% of public company misstatement settlements are for more than $50 million. Another important consideration if you're looking at SEC settlements is the composition between disgorgement, which is designed to be an equitable remedy that would be essentially the give up of gains due to the alleged fraud, and civil penalties. And generally, the higher the ratio of civil penalties, especially when you're looking at a company, generally signals a more egregious problem or action. Companies pay somewhat more in civil penalties than disgorgement. On average, company settlements are composed of 40% disgorgement, 52% civil penalties, and 2% prejudgment interest. Now, for the remainder of my talk, I'd like to analyze the Goldman settlement in terms of its size and allocation in relation to the statistics and practices we know the SEC follows, or considerations it uses. And, of course, Chudozier has already given some profile of the issues. As I already mentioned, this is the third largest SEC settlement ever. And one of the ways the SEC evaluates settlements with public companies is as a percentage of market capitalization, or which it looks at it to as a measure of the capacity to repay. So that positive statistically significant relationship between market cap and settlement size is no coincidence. The Goldman settlement at $550 million came out to 0.7% of Goldman's $775 billion market cap on the eve of settlement. So that's quite large. Over 0.5% gets you into a large range, but not up at that 1% threshold that the SEC has indicated it considers extraordinary. But because Goldman's stock rose over 4% on the day the settlement was announced, it was announced after the closing, but there was anticipation of a settlement, that one-day rise was over 6 times the value of the settlement. So by reaching that settlement, Goldman was still able to add five times that amount to its market cap after subtracting the value of the settlement. Now, the distribution of the settlement is interesting. The $550 million payment is going to be split between government revenue and a fair fund to compensate two investors in the deal. So the largest share, or $300 million, goes to the U.S. Treasury as government revenue. And the remaining $250 million will be split between the two investors in the Abacus 2007 AC1 deal, or two of the investors. There were only 4 investors, and the remaining 2 were involved in the structuring the deal, Goldman itself and ACA, which selected the penalty with as is the source of the allegation, input from Paulson. German bank IKB will receive $150 million. This is equal to its entire investment in the Abacus deal, which is now reported to be valueless. The Royal Bank of Scotland will receive the remaining $100 million, compared to the reported losses of $841 million. RBS acquired ABN AMRO, which was an original investor in the super senior tranche of the Abacus deal. So RBS is receiving about 12%, or 12 cents on the dollar, compared to its loss, compared to IKB's full compensation. Now, I'm certainly not privy to the SEC's thinking on this matter, but I will note a difference between the nature of the two investments that may have affected the SEC's decision. And to understand this, we need to discuss the structure of a synthetic CDO, such as the Abacus deal. Because synthetic CDOs have two kinds of investors. There are the funded class investors who, just like any other bond investor, make an upfront payment to invest in the security, and then expect to hopefully receive a return on this. A synthetic CDO also sells credit protection to other investors by selling credit default swaps, and it needs to be prepared to make contingent payments if there are losses on those credit default, on the reference bonds underlying those credit default swaps. So in the case of Abacus, ultimately the protection buyer was Paulson. IKB invested in one of these funded classes of the deal, so it made an upfront payment of $150 million for notes that then lost value. In contrast, ABN AMRO was an unfunded class investor, so it made no upfront payment at purchase, but it had to be prepared to make contingent payments at a later date. So if the Abacus structure had to make contingent payments in excess of the value of the funds that had been put up by the funded class investors, plus any interest or returns that had been earned on that, then unfunded investors like ABN AMRO would need to put up money to pay the CDS protection buyers. And that's where ABN AMRO ultimately made these over $840 million in contingent payments. So because an unfunded class investor hopes to get a return without laying out any cash up front, the SEC may have viewed this as a more aggressive or more speculated investment. Essentially, it's a leveraged investment, so seen a lower rate of compensation to be appropriate. Because clearly, under that $550 million settlement, after compensating IKB, there were $400 million left. There was the potential under that settlement amount, if that was viewed to be the appropriate amount, to have compensated almost 50 cents on the dollar to ABN AMRO. But instead, it chose a lower rate of compensation and to give the remainder to the Treasury. Let me close by noting that all the data I cited today comes from NERA's proprietary database on SEC settlements. We've gathered data on all SEC settlements since Sarbanes-Oxley, over 5,800 such settlements. And we make all of this data, or much of this data, publicly available on www.securitieslitigationtrends.com. So if you found this interesting, you can refer to the website for more information to review the data and for our semi-annual papers on SEC settlement trends. Thanks very much, Lisa.
Thank you. It's very interesting to hear about those settlement trends. Let me now take a moment to ask each of you some questions. And I'll actually start with Chris. And I think I said before, you talked about some very interesting issues with regard to asset-backed securities, I think, in particular, in talking about this notion of them being toxic. One of the questions I had was, given the kind of really negative view that people have of securities and this notion that they're quote-unquote toxic, what do you think is the future? There was, at some point, perhaps really exaggerated claims that perhaps we shouldn't use these types of securities anymore, and certainly some discussion about minimizing their use in a variety of different ways. What's your take on how they should be used kind of going forward?
Well, I think there's been more reasonable talk of late that considers the virtues of securitization and how that it actually helps consumers and has a rational purpose for investors. And so clearly a trend towards more transparency and less reliance, perhaps, on the credit rating agencies is something that is important and is getting written into rules. So I think Reg AB is one that would require a significant amount of additional disclosure and provide underlying assets within asset-backed security, not just provide the assets in a list, but also provide sort of a cash flow model. And so that's going to provide a lot more detail to investors that want to take a closer look and have a better understanding of the positions.
Sure. And of course, speaking of new rules, we have the new act, the Dodd-Frank Act that the president just signed into law. And I don't know if you had a chance to take a look at it. I understand there are some provisions that deal with asset-backed securities. If you have seen it, do you have any kind of overall impressions about what you think it would mean for asset-backed securities, what type of impact the reform will have in that area?
Sure. Well, I think one part of it has to do with the reliance on the credit ratings. And basically, that's being removed from banking regulation. So the bank regulators that traditionally for decades have relied on credit ratings from the NRSROs, the nationally recognized statistically rating organizations like Moody's and Standard & Poor's and Fitch, are being asked to study where references to their ratings are in the banking regulation and remove it. And so with respect to asset-backed securities, a regional or community bank that normally could purchase an asset-backed security of a certain rating and know that it's within the law or within the regulations of what it might hold in its investment portfolio now is going to be faced with some other potentially more nebulous task of asserting what the creditworthiness of an issue is and convincing its regulators that it's okay. So that'll be interesting to see how that plays out, how the regulations are rewritten to basically pull out the NRSRO ratings as a factor.
Yeah, sure. And that kind of segues into a question I wanted to ask Chu, which was, there are, both in, I think, in the new act, but also kind of in general, there was a lot of discussion about the role of credit rating agencies in connection with, potentially creating inaccuracies related to structured products. So I wanted to get your sense about whether you think the description of that role and the potential negative impact of rating agencies is accurate and kind of whether or not you think there's anything that could be done with respect to that, if in fact you think rating agencies are part of the problem, if you will, in creating inaccuracies with respect to those products.
Well, I think the background here is that there are allegations that in certain cases, underwriters or structurers rating shopped, essentially played the rating agencies off against one another in an effort to get the most lenient treatment for a deal. I think before we talk about that, it's worthy of note that some of the more recent deals that have come out have much higher quality collateral than the deals that came out before the crisis or during the crisis or before the crisis, and far more over collateralization because that's the only way that people are really interested in them at this point. Going back to your question about the rating agencies, I think this harkens back to something I talked about briefly, which was the whole principal agent problem. And the ratings agencies are meant to be agents for investors, right? The problem that leads to a perceived conflict of interest on their part is that they're paid by other agents in the deal. It's a sticky problem because, according to the rating agencies, their business model, as set up currently, is the only one that's really going to work for them. Essentially, the idea is that people don't want to pay. The investors don't want to pay the rating agencies. So it's a difficult problem, and I'm unsure of how it's going to be dealt with.
Yeah, you know, I certainly agree with that assessment that it's definitely something difficult to kind of get your hands around. I also wanted to ask you, follow up on, I said we were going to talk, you talked a lot about asymmetrical information and that being one of the kind of critical problems in this area. I wondered, especially in light of the comment you just made about the kind of newer deals and the nature of the collateral there, that should we be as concerned about the problems associated with asymmetrical in this new kind of tightening environment with respect to credit and the like?
I think that the market is, well, yes, we should be concerned. And I think that you're going to see efforts to minimize the potential for it. I don't think you can ever completely eliminate it. But that's, I think, Chris sort of touched upon that when he mentioned greater transparency. I think investors are going to demand greater transparency into what they're investing in as the only way that they're going to part with their capital.
Yeah. You know, certainly, I think, you know, a lot of the issues surrounding the financial crisis, people were talking about opaqueness. And so I think transparency as a counter to that is something that we're certainly likely to see in the future. Let me turn to Elaine now. Just you talked about a number of different really intriguing facts with respect to SEC settlements. One thing you said that I wondered if you could just elaborate on a little bit is that 72%, I think, is the figure you use of settlements, there was no financial components associated with. And I wonder, what does that mean? What should we take from that? Should we be concerned that there are kind of a large amount of settlements that actually don't have any financial piece of it, or is that a good thing?
Well, first of all, that's out of settlements with public companies relating to misstatements. And so these are companies that have investors. And one of the primary considerations, of course, the SEC takes into consideration is, did the company itself get any financial gain? So does the company get money from some other party, including its investors, that it should be returning? Another primary consideration is, who were the investors at the time and who are the investors today? Because the, you know, consideration is, for example, if they're all the same investors, do you want to just sort of transfer money from the company owned by the investors back to the investors? And what would those impact be? So it's not necessarily problematic. You know, depending on the nature of the settlement, the nature of the admissions or acknowledgments, the carefully negotiated text that goes with the settlement, that can still matter. There can also be reforms that are required out of it, as is the case in the Goldman settlement. So it's not necessarily problematic. It could actually be fair to investors. And I think the SEC has actually been very transparent about how they think about these issues.
Excellent. Another thing you said that was kind of very intriguing is you talked about the Goldman settlement and the fact that it kind of, after the settlement, it kind of added to its market cap. And I wondered, does that suggest on the opposite end that these kind of large settlements actually could have some positive impact for corporations and their shareholders? Was that just a fluke? What does that mean in terms of settlements?
Well, like almost any other piece of news that's expected coming into the markets, the way that the company's stock or security would react is generally a question of what is the news compared to what the market was expecting. Yeah. So there was a lot of discussion that the Goldman settlement could have been as high as $1 billion. Yeah. So $550 million actually looked like a relatively less expensive settlement. I think there are also suggestions that the market's going to take away from that in terms of how problematic was the conduct behind it. If there was a $550 million settlement versus a $1 billion settlement, and the fact that there is actually no admission of fraud in it. So both in terms of the magnitude of the dollar value of the settlement and the nature of the admissions that were and were not in the settlement, no admission of a fraud, but the word mistake, I think the settlement looked less problematic than the market feared it might have.
Yeah. I guess the other question I wanted to ask you is kind of, what do you think is the future going forward? The one thing you talked about is the kind of history of settlements, and it's starting off at this kind of very narrow insider trading. Now it seems like not only the amount, but the nature of the suits that the SEC has coverage over is broadened. Do you think that trend is likely to?
Well, it's not actually a change. That history isn't so much a change in the kinds of cases it could bring. It's when it's able to ask for a fine, basically. And I think that the shift to using that penalty authority to compensate investors is very reasonable and very consistent with the goals of the SEC in terms of protecting investors, among other things. I think an interesting question is that one of the things that occurs with the Dodd-Frank Act is that there's now a lot of overlapping authority and more possible overlaps between the SEC, the CFTC, and the new Consumer Financial Protection Agency. And so I think we could possibly see the SEC bringing penalties in other areas or not.
Yeah.
So I think that's something that remains to be developed as those overlaps and how enforcement will work out will remain to be seen.
Yeah, I think we're definitely going to obviously see a lot of changes to come with the new act. I actually wanted to go back to Chris for a second because I was thinking about changes and kind of comparing history to now. One of the things you talked about is there were misconceptions about asset-backed securities, and one of the misconceptions that it was a kind of new thing. And in fact, it had this kind of history behind it. But another thing people said about the security was actually that it became riskier over time. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that. Do you think that is a misconception as well? Or do you think, that in fact the asset-backed securities, kind of the risk level with respect to them was essentially the same?
Well, I think if there's a sort of a general conclusion is that if you look in the mid-2000s, underwriting standards, whether you're talking about assets that were ending up in asset-backed securities or assets that were ending up on bank balance sheets as outright loans probably deteriorated. And this is across the different sectors. So I think the famous quote by Chuck Prince about you having to dance as long as there's music and was in relation to corporate leverage loans. That's where he thought there was too much aggressiveness in the terms and the covenants, and it ended up that the mortgage space sort of had problems first and more broadly than was expected. So certainly there was some issues where underwriting standards deteriorated, and for whatever reason, the regulators didn't push back forcefully enough, strongly enough, or didn't have the power to do so. Some of the entities were unregulated. Some of them chased the unregulated entities to continue getting business. And so there were some of those issues that are system-wide, and I think that's a lot of what Dodd-Frank tried to get at, was we can't have pockets that are hidden, that are doing the same things as the pockets that are regulated, because it ends up being sort of a race to the bottom. So I wouldn't say that structured finance or asset-backed securities had unique issues with what was going on in terms of the quality. I think it was more broad. And you know, part of what was going on had to do with information asymmetries, as Chu spoke about. Part of it just had to do with not understanding the level of risk in the entire system, and so there were misestimates and errors on both parts.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, I think Chu's discussion about informational asymmetries is a really, I think, important one. And my question before about whether or not we should still be concerned, I think you're exactly right to say absolutely. I've asked everyone else what they thought the future of their various topics were. What do you think the future of these kinds of products are going forward? Given,
I think that you're going to see a resuscitation of the market. But like Chris, I think that investors will demand increased transparency. I think there will be legal changes also that have already started to occur, which will limit the ability of people to completely offload the risks in deals. But I think you're going to see structures that are simpler, much easier to understand, much more subordination, higher quality collateral. I think we all accept that the idea of no doc loans is gone.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think you're likely in a few years to see a relatively healthy marketplace, or at least as healthy as the economy will allow.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Well, let me just add that if we're all being a little bit cagey in some areas about Dodd-Frank, one of the reasons why is that in many areas it lays out broad principles or broad objectives, mm-hmm. and the details still remain to be worked out through rulemakings by the various agencies. And those are going to be public processes. There will be proposed rules and comment processes. And so there are a lot of details yet to be worked out.
I think that's exactly right. And, of course, there are a lot of Dodd-Frank is about research reports and studies, you know, which is in many ways probably a good move because we probably do need to learn more. There's a lot of room for that in terms of what's happened in terms of these products, in terms of issues like asymmetrical information and misconceptions, of course. I also, I guess I wanted to just ask you one more question. You were talking about in wrapping up, what do we think going forward, more cases like Goldman, we think in terms of?
I think that both FINRA and the SEC are examining a number of deals. There are allegations of mis-selling, inadequate disclosure. So, yes, I think there are going to be more cases where, again, these issues of information asymmetry and ability to control deal outcomes will be at the center of what's being examined. And as I said, in the absence of any directly observable facts, you're going to need to look at the data and draw inferences about the behavior of certain parties.
Yeah, yeah. Certainly, that's a very good point to keep in mind. I want to think through silver linings for investors. and so one of the things I'll ask Elaine about is fair funds. You know, you talked a bit about fair funds. You know, do you think it's working, you know, in terms of kind of getting funds out to investors in a kind of organized and timely way?
Well, the fair funds definitely are distributed. I don't know about the timeline, and it's a little bit variable. One of the things is that when you create a fair fund, then there has to be a rule created for how the fund would be allocated to the various investors at the relevant time. And then all those investors need to be identified. They need to be tracked down if their addresses have changed before checks can be cut and then sent to them. So it can take some time, but the fair funds have, you know, been created and they've been distributed in a number of cases.
Yeah. You know, I certainly think, you know, both in terms of trying to get some, you also talked a little bit about disgorgement too. Issues like that I think are really important to keep in mind, you know, through all of this crisis, which I, you know, I think like all of the rest of you guys here are, you know, hopeful about Dodd-Frank, but also about the market and where it's going to be going. And I think more importantly about the types of products we've been talking about. And, you know, because I think they don't start from a kind of they don't have a negative background. They're only kind of being used in potentially negative ways. So
I think there's a lot of importance in getting the market resuscitated to some extent, because with banks and bank capital requirements, all the underlying assets that were financed with asset-backed securities aren't going to be able to be absorbed with the sort of re-intermediation onto bank balance sheets because capital requirements are higher. There's not as much leverage around. So the question is, if asset-backed securities aren't able to sort of carry some of that, where is it going to come from?
You know, certainly, again, I think you're exactly right. I think the kind of one of the really important things to keep in mind with the resuscitation is that we don't lose things like asset-backed securities and these other products that I think can really be a positive force in the resuscitation, even though some have labeled them toxics or what have you. I don't know if anyone else has any. We're probably getting ready to close out the program. I don't know if anyone else has any final thoughts or remarks they want to make before we do that.
Thank you for having us.
Oh, absolutely.
Thanks, Lisa.
Thank you.
Thank you. It has been an incredibly interesting conversation. So I want to thank all of you guys, Elaine, Chris, and Chu, for not only making sure we have a very engaging discussion about these very, I think, important topics, but also, of course, for sharing your excerpts from the papers from the NERA Economic Consulting's recent Finance, Law, and Securities Litigation Seminar. I think we can all certainly appreciate why your presentations were deemed to be the best at this year's conference. Today's broadcast can be accessed again at any time through the virtual museum and archive, and an edited transcript will soon be available. The museum's next broadcast will be Bingham Presents 2010 on Wednesday, September 29th, beginning at 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The program will be broadcast live from the offices of Bingham McCutcheon LLP in New York, and online at www.sechistorical.org. The online broadcast will be free and accessible worldwide without prior registration. The program will look at harmonization of the regulation of investment advisors and broker-dealers. Professor Eric Seary of Babson College, a member of the Society's Museum Committee and a former director of the SEC Division of Then Market Regulation, will moderate the program. Presenters will include W. Hardy Calcutt of Bingham McCutcheon LLP, Mark Shelton of UBS AG, and David Titsworth of Investment Advisor Association. Please plan to join us on www.sechistorical.org on September 29th. And thank you again for being with us today.